Thanks for joining us on Current State this Friday morning. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. We're kind of all over the place on today's show. I mean, all over the world, that is. Later, we discuss the U.S. involvement in the Pinochet coup in Chile. We also have Canadian folk musician John Brooks trying to figure out what exactly it means to be labeled a folk artist. I don't know either these days. He's going to play some music for us as well. And a little closer to home, we have an essay from our contributor, Jeffrey Ray, about the city of Detroit in film. But first, the third annual Michigan Transportation Odyssey is going on this week. Various stakeholders of Michigan transportation throughout the state took on the challenge of traveling across Michigan using only passenger transportation. Yes, that's right, bikes, buses, and trains. This cross-state trip serves as a way to assess Michigan's problems firsthand, but also celebrate Michigan for public transportation for the Public Transportation Authority's achievements and innovations. Catherine Gray, the coordinator of the trip, is currently participating in the three-day trek from Traverse City to Detroit, and she's calling us now from the road to give us an update. She is in Kalamazoo. Catherine, welcome to Current State.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing this morning? Tired, or has it been stressful?
It has been a little stressful. We are exhausted. Half of our group is out on the trail right now, touring the Kalamazoo River Trail and how they're connected to the local bus system. But yeah, yesterday we ran into some problems, which is good for us to note, with some accessibility issues. So we're a little bit exhausted, but we are trucking away.
Yeah, this sounds kind of like a logistical nightmare to me, trying to get from Traverse City to Detroit. Tell me a little bit about how it does work logistically. How has this all been planned out?
Well, it's taken about a month is when we started looking at schedules. Bus schedules, they kind of change depending on, you know, the week, and sometimes even just 2 to 3 days ahead of time they can change the bus schedule on you. So last year we did the Odyssey in 3 days. This year we did in 2 days. And so we really have no time kind of gap. And that's kind of one of the things we wanted to look at was if somebody was traveling and, you know, they had to make connections, would they'd be able to make that. And so we have Indian Trails connecting with local buses, connecting with Amtrak, and there's not very much time in between. And so yesterday we saw what happens when we miss, when our bus is late and we miss connections. So
what'd you guys end up doing after that missed connection yesterday?
Well, what happened was, is yesterday we were in Traverse City and, we were, about 45 minutes late due to some accessibility. We have two individuals in wheelchairs traveling with us. And despite calls into Indian Trails telling them that we had some individuals with wheelchairs with us, the driver still was not informed. And so that took about an hour and a half just before. It took about 45 minutes before we could get them up on the lift and everything like that, and then an hour and a half. So there were about 50 passengers on who were trying to make connections into Grand Rapids who had totally missed those connections. We had missed our entire tour in Grand Rapids because of that. So fortunately, we had about an hour delay in terms of when we needed to get to our Indian Trails bus to get to Kalamazoo. So we were thankful enough not to benefit or not to have any consequences directly hit us except for missing our tour. But there were probably about 50% of the people on the bus who missed their connection to Detroit or to Chicago.
For most of the people on this trip, it's their job to improve transportation, the transportation system in Michigan. How does it feel to, instead of assessing it from a behind a desk, why are you guys going out and making this trek?
Well, it's one thing to talk about some of the issues that we face on a day-to-day basis with transportation issues, but it's a whole other thing to go out and actually experience it. Kind of like when you talk about it in school, but it's a whole other thing to go out and practice it. And so what we want to try to show is that, one, again, celebrate some of the great things that some communities are doing, but at the same time show that we still have a lot of work to do in terms of connecting our public transit system in terms of an entire state. Some local communities are really great at connecting you to your local community, but what if I want to get inner city, and how does that work? And so that's one of the things that we're really trying to show is, how does it work? Can someone do it? What does it look like? What are the challenges that you face?
Have you looked to other examples in other states that have a stronger regional transportation system?
Well, several states have some larger urban metro areas that have really large regional transit systems, or they have connector buses that go out into the suburbs. And that's, I think, what Michigan's trying to do with the newly the new legislation for the RTA in Southeast Michigan. Detroit's the last urban core to have an RTA, and we're really hoping that great things come from the RTA. And so I think that's kind of an example where we've looked at a couple of different communities throughout the state to see that happen. Every state, I think, struggles with how to connect your entire state using public transportation. But with Michigan being a very touristic state, I think it's really important for us to figure out how we can do that.
You've already addressed some of them, but you've already briefly talked about some of the cities that you're stopping in and celebrating strong points. Can you give a little more depth and example regarding that?
So up in Traverse City, we took a tour on their trails. They have the new Heritage Trail that we were able to see how it connects with the local bus system and then also connects us to Indian Trails. In Ann Arbor, we're going to be presenting an award to the University of Michigan, the Clean Energy Coalition, the City of Ann Arbor, and the Ride for their work on the newly approved bike share. So we're going to be able to kind of go see where that potential bike share station could be and things like that. And congratulate them on all the work that they're doing there. And then we'll take the air ride to the Detroit Metro Airport, where we will then hop on a smart bus and hopefully make a connection to DDOT to get downtown for our event this evening, our finale event in Detroit. So a little bit of bus touring, a little bit of trail touring, and then from each city we do, you know, a major system like Amtrak or Indian Trails.
Why is it important to build stronger regional systems throughout the state?
Well, I think the economy is a big piece. One of the things that, you know, we talk to universities, we talk to medical institutions, we talk to people who are economic developers, and they, you know, the way that we work nowadays is everything doesn't happen in your local community. We need to be able to get to other places, and we need to be able to do it efficiently and affordably and effectively. And sometimes the car is not the best way to do that. You know, the car is not the most environmentally friendly when you need to travel six people from one place. You know, that's going to be a minivan or two cars. So why not hop on a train and be able to do that much more leisurely? Plus, you can, you know, be on the internet, do work, sleep, instead of have to drive. So I think for the economy, it's really important that we do this. It's an amenity that the younger generations are wanting. We need to keep up with that if we want to be attractive as a state to the rest of the nation.
Catherine Gay calling us from Kalamazoo. She is the coordinator for the 3rd Annual Michigan Transportation Odyssey. Good luck on the rest of your journey.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This month marks the 40th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup in Chile, which elevated General Augusto Pinochet to power. In 1973, Pinochet and his forces, with crucial help from the CIA, overthrew Chile's democratically elected president, socialist Salvador Allende. Thousands went missing or were killed, and tens of thousands were tortured during Pinochet's 25-year reign. Peter Kornbluh has worked to declassify U.S. government documents which shed light on America's relationship with Pinochet. Kornbluh directs a Chile documentation project at the National Security Archive. He is also the author of the recently reissued book, The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Kornbluh starts by laying out the political scene across Latin America before Allende's 1970 election.
You had a number of elected governments in the Southern Cone throughout Latin America. You had kind of dynastic dictatorships in Nicaragua and Paraguay, where Fray Stroessner ruled. And, of course, you had the famous military coup in 1964 in Brazil, the dominant country in the region. And the Brazilian government actually, much like the U.S. government, was very focused on preventing progressive governments from coming into office around it. It preferred the community of military nations, but at the time of Allende's election, that wasn't the case.
Kissinger claimed that Allende's election posed one of the most serious challenges facing the hemisphere. Could you expand a little on why Kissinger saw this as such a threat from Chile, this election?
The irony of Kissinger writing that statement to President Richard Nixon in November of 1970 is that just the year before, in 1969, he had had a conversation with the Chilean foreign minister, Juan Gabriel Valdez, and told him that Chile was a dagger pointed at the heart of Antarctica. In other words, a threat to an iceberg. In other words, really a threat to nothing. Until Allende was elected, there wasn't really an issue, with the exception of the fact that the Chileans throughout the 60s and even the moderate Christian Democrats Party were moving slowly but steadily to nationalizing Chile's copper industry, which was owned by two American corporate giants, Anaconda and Kennecott. Then Allende gets elected. And from one day to the next, Kissinger is lobbying Nixon to undermine, overthrow, destabilize him. Why? As he writes in this extraordinary memo that's in my new book, The Pinochet File, A Declassified Dossier on Atrocity and Accountability. Why? Because, among other things, Allende is democratically elected. As Kissinger writes, he has legitimacy, and we can't deny him his legitimacy. And other leaders like him, Socialist Party leaders, will build coalitions with leftist parties in other countries, communist parties, moderately leftist parties, and win democratic elections and will be legitimate. And as Kissinger writes, there will be an insidious model effect of these elections if Allende succeeds. There will be an imitative spread of this phenomena, quote unquote, that might reach as far as the European countries of Italy. And perhaps other countries there, Greece, Spain, France.
And this actually does happen.
Socialists eventually do get elected in those countries. Nothing happens to the NATO alliance, as Kissinger feared. But as he told Richard Nixon at the time, you know, we can't allow Allende to succeed because other countries will get an idea that this is the way to go, and it will shift the balance of power in the world and our position in it.
So the way to get Allende out is a coup, and that's a coup by General Pinochet. So first of all, explain a little bit who Pinochet was.
Well, General Augusto Pinochet Ugarte was, at the time, the commander-in-chief of the Chilean army. He had risen through the ranks. He was actually one of the members of the military branches, the leaders of there was the army, the navy, the Air Force, and the National Police. And he was the leader, somewhat the least out front of being a coup plotter, but he commanded the most powerful wing of the armed forces, the army itself. He was someone whose name quickly became synonymous with human rights violations, and I would say that whose name, in some ways is kind of more associated with vile human rights crimes than anybody else in the world except for Adolf Hitler.
Chile, a pretty bad place under Pinochet then.
Well, it was. And yeah. Chileans today, on the 40th anniversary of the coup, are recognizing that in the size and scale of the repression, in some ways, was smaller than other countries like Argentina, where there were 30,000 disappeared. But because it was Chile and because of the great clash between the hopes for peaceful change towards more social equality that Allende represented and the extraordinary repression and bloodshed that Pinochet not only oversaw but then represented, Chile became a symbol to the world, much as Franco's Spain in the 40s and 50s was a symbol of repression.
You campaigned for years to declassify government documents relating to the U.S.'s support of Pinochet and their involvement in the coup. What exactly was the U.S.'s involvement in overthrowing Allende and in supporting Pinochet from what you found from the documents that you talk about in your book?
You know, Allende was elected on September 4th, 1970. On September 13th, 1970, weeks before he was actually inaugurated as president or actually stepped foot in the presidential palace, Henry Kissinger basically told the State Department that the decision had been made to foment a coup to actually prevent Allende from being inaugurated. And Richard Nixon instructed the CIA on September 15th, 11 days after the election, to go make the economy scream, quote unquote, to spend more than $10 million or any amount they needed, to give a game plan to Kissinger, who was going to oversee these operations. And the first phase of this effort was actually to keep him from becoming president. They wanted a preemptive strike. He'd never even set foot in office and issued a single decree or policy that would affect the United States. And they were already attempting to overthrow him. And those attempts were quite extraordinary. They included a sinister plot to kidnap the commander-in-chief of the Chilean Armed Forces at the time, General René Schneider, who didn't support a coup. Kissinger and company and the CIA decided they had came up with this grand plan. They would kidnap this guy, get him out of the way so that somebody else could take over the military and order a coup. And they would blame Allende's people for kidnapping General Schneider, as if Allende's people would have any reason to do that. And instead of kidnapping him, the plotters that were paid by the CIA killed him, murdered him. And this is what happened in Chile. And of course, everybody's blamed the right, the coup plotters, and even the United States. The CIA paid $35,000 to the coup plotters to keep their mouths shut about their ties to the U.S. and to help them escape the country so that they would never have to face a court of law. So that was the first phase. And then after Allende was actually inaugurated, when that plot failed, Kissinger pressed Nixon to overrule the State Department that wanted to coexist with Allende, and made it clear that we had to make Allende fail so that his model effect wouldn't be a positive model for the world. And the U.S. worked covertly. The CIA funneled hundreds of thousands of dollars into the leading newspaper, anti-Allende newspaper, El Mercurio, so that it could write editorials, print false articles, and basically call for a coup. And we did a lot of covert operations, black propaganda, try and sow dissension within the ranks of the left. Then there were economic policies. We quietly cut off bilateral and multilateral loans to Allende, and he almost got zero money from any of the international lending institutions and no credits from the United States. As soon as Pinochet took power, the spigot of economic support was turned back on. And the United States actually continued to secretly fund El Mercurio and in order so that it could print all sorts of positive articles about Pinochet and the coup and obfuscate and hide the repression that was going on.
I'm Emmanuel Berry speaking with Peter Kornbluh, director of the Chile Documentation Project at the National Security Archive and the author of The Pinochet File. You mentioned briefly there that there were people against this within the U.S. government, that Kissinger's kind of going against his own colleagues in that. And in the re-release of your book, marking the 40th anniversary of the coup this month, there's new documentation of a conversation between Nixon and Kissinger right after the coup. What does that say? What did they talk about in that conversation?
You know, your listeners will be interesting to know that Henry Kissinger secretly taped his phone conversations. And he didn't tell anybody that he was doing this. And so when the president would call him, you had this ironic situation in which Kissinger was secretly taping the call and Nixon was secretly taping the call. In Kissinger's case, he had all of these tapes transcribed, usually on the day that they were made, so that every day's worth of his phone conversations were transcribed by a secretary paid by the U.S. taxpayer. And this created a body of about 30,000 pages of what we call telcons, telephone conversation transcripts. Kissinger took these with him when he left office in early 1977. He claimed they were his private papers when, in fact, the U.S. taxpayer had paid for every single page to be created. So they couldn't be his private papers. And my organization, the National Security Archive, which pushes for less secrecy and more declassification, identified this massive trove of extraordinary historically rich documentation and pressed the U.S. government, including drawing up a lawsuit, to retrieve what were essentially stolen documents. When we showed our lawsuit to U.S. officials it was clear that they were going to lose this case, and they made Kissinger give these documents back. And among these documents was the transcript of the very first conversation after the coup that Nixon and Kissinger have, where they congratulate each other. They commiserate over the fact that the liberal media is kind of against the coup. They discuss what the U.S. did. Nixon asked, does our hand show in you know, overthrowing Allende? And Kissinger says, we didn't do it, referring to direct participation in the coup. He says, I mean, we helped them, blank, which I believe is a reference to the CIA, created the conditions as best as possible, which really does sum up in a nutshell what the U.S. role was, to create a coup climate, to stabilize Allende, foment the opposition and instability in which a coup would take place and succeed. And then at the very end, as they're talking about the issue of why they can't just come forward and take credit for this, Kissinger says, you know, in the Eisenhower period, we would be heroes. Now, I just want to tell you, finally, that this document is the one U.S. declassified document that is part of a special exhibit on the 40th anniversary of the coup that has been mounted
in Chile.
In Chile, in the Museum of Human Rights and Memory. They did a special event, a special exhibit called Registros del Golpe, kind of images of the coup, in which they had all sorts of various types of documents and papers and photographs. And they used one U.S. document, and it was this transcript of Nixon and Kissinger patting each other on the back after the coup took place, taking credit for what happened and deciding that they were both heroes. I can guarantee you that the people in Chile looking at this document in the museum didn't see Henry Kissinger or Richard Nixon as a hero.
Peter Kornbluh directs the Cuba Documentation Project and the Chile Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. His book, The Pinochet File, a Declassified Dossier on Atrocity and Accountability, has been reissued in remembrance of the coup's 40th anniversary. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here at Michigan State.
Canadian musician John Brooks' album Delicate Cages reworks folk tradition to tell modern stories. Honor killings, child soldiers turned cage fighters, and the beauty of mercy are just some of the subjects Brooks takes on in his work. Brooks' desire to write narratives through music stems back to his travels through Eastern Europe in the late 1990s.
I'm 45 now. I was 28 at the time when I was doing all that traveling, and I believed, I think as a lot of people in their 20s do, if I just go to the place, I'll be able to understand what's going on, because I'm not getting anything out of the newspapers. I can't figure out, you know, what's going on in this part of the world, and I wanted to learn more about it. So I just thought, I'm going to go there. And I got my backpack, and I went there, and it was crazy. There was no infrastructure for passport situations like that. I mean, they just laughed when they saw my passport. They let me in at my own peril. And and when I saw that place, I came home with this this heroic kind of inspired idea that, you know, the Western world needs to hear about these stories. And this is my job now. And, of course, I didn't have the language or any of the tools necessary to write such songs, and that was in, what was that, 97? It wasn't until 2005 that I actually picked up the guitar again, because it took me that long
to figure out how to
do that. Mm-hmm. And first and foremost, educate myself. I was a rebellious kid that never read a book until I was 25. You know, I wasn't ready for school. I wasn't I educated myself. I went back to school. I went to university.
I was going to say, I find that surprising, because your music has a lot of kind of literary references. Your latest album is named related to poetry. It's called Delicate Cages.
Yes.
How do you think, from that first album in 2005, 2006, how have you changed as a writer between that time and that latest album that came out in 2012?
The thing that I noticed the most, the biggest change, is I've learned how to say more with less words and for lack of a better word, I think I've become a little less esoteric. That first album was pretty densely layered with some strange and I wouldn't say strange, but I would say obscure literary references. You know, an Irish poet named James Clarence Mangan. You know, there was one song where I quote him and things like that. And I still love the album and I like the songs and everything. But I think today I'm more. And this comes from playing live in front of audiences and standing in front of people and singing. I've become more urgent in communicating, and I've become much more clear, I think.
You still have stuck with some of your literary references in your work. You have a Robert Bly poem, Taking of the Hands, Taking of the Hands of Someone You Love. You see, they are delicate cages, the name of your album.
Right.
Why did you choose to name your album from a piece of poetry?
Paradoxes are in every one of my songs. That's probably the thing that fascinates me more than anything, the concept that opposites are equal, the concept that if you pursue an idea to its furthest extreme, it becomes its opposite, and paradoxes are in every underlying everything I do. And I was interested in the ideas of freedom and enslavement, freedom and imprisonment. And I knew that if I just sort of I knew that if I did an album if I called it freedom and imprisonment, something simple like that, that immediately a negative connotation would be taken from it. People generally don't think of cages as positive, but as the Robert Bly poem suggests, there are such things as good cages. I mean, we decide, we make decisions, and our decisions are in and of themselves cages to some degree, and that's a good thing. That's the freedom of choosing what we do and whom we love, you know. And those are cages too, and they're not necessarily bad cages. And I wanted to make that that obvious in the title.
Would you play something for us?
Absolutely, Mercy, the key to most cages. Cool. All right, here we go. Well, I used to admire most a melody and what it could do with love and words. And I used to admire most the poet who, with her pen, untangle this world into verse. And I used to admire all I thought was profound. I plagiarized the prophets and the saints. Ah, but now that I'm older, oh, it's mercy that I admire most. Oh, it's mercy that I admire most. And I waited out my low youth in a fallow spectacle, in line snaking round coliseums. Yes, I marched in a drench under fame's soft fist clenched, and I paid all the scalpers just to see him. Ah, but now that I'm older, oh, it's mercy that I admire most. Oh, it's mercy that I admire. I admire the pure of heart that will one thing, and I admire the steady in their team, and I admire decision in the mind that endures it, and those who speak though they be shamed. And I admire all the reckless
voiceless, voices for the voiceless, and the man standing in the path of tanks. Ah, but now, now that I'm older, oh, it's mercy that I admire most. Oh, it's mercy that I admire most. Mercy.
That was John Books performing his song Mercy off his album Delicate Cages. Your album, as you've mentioned, covers a wide range of topics from cage fighting to Palestinian suicide bombers, language laws. Why cover, I guess when I think of folk music, I don't think of modern political issues. Why cover this kind of in this genre that a lot of people associate with the old?
Well, I am the more I pursue this career, the harder time I have, it seems, with trying to decide what is folk music. I have to admit, I know that I'm a link in a chain of performers and songwriters that are now regarded as folk songwriters. Mm-hmm. I know that much. I also know that a number of my heroes in folk song tradition, you know, Woody Guthrie, for example, Buffy St. Marie, Dylan, I know that a lot of the people that influenced me were part of a subversive genre of songwriting. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that's one reason why you might some of the topical aspects of the song. But you know, this goes back to the idea of writing what I want to know more about, writing what I'm interested in. I don't know that there's been a time in human history where there's been more of a glut of information and stuff available to us. Like, there just seems to be endless. I mean, we're getting to the point where we just can't take any more of it. And I can't imagine imposing myself and my songs and another CD onto the pile
of stuff
of claptrap if it didn't raise some serious questions about who we are and where we're at in the aim to improve ourselves a bit and. First and foremost, in the aim to have compassion and empathy for each other a bit more. So I suppose that's why some of the subjects, that might explain in part as to why I chase after certain subjects. I'm looking for subjects that seem to be on the pulse of contemporary wounds.
I know that the genre of folk is kind of being defined within it is kind of difficult, I guess, or maybe not the most accurate way to describe use an artist. But what is the folk scene like in Canada versus America? Is there much of a difference?
Oh, good question. I don't know. I'm really at the moment. And by moment, I mean in the last, say, 6-7 months, conflicted with the term folk.
Yeah.
If I play a folk club, whether it's in Canada or, whether it's on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, or whether it's in Houston, Texas, and it's called a folk club, I know one thing, and it's not, and it doesn't make me happy, and that's the majority of the people in that crowd are going to be over 50 years old. And sometimes, as unheroic as it may sound, when I'm sitting there playing and singing, I'm not necessarily thinking about the song Mercy. I'm sometimes thinking, who am I going to be playing to in 20 years? Honestly. So that's one of those characteristics, that's a characteristic of that folk scene that I would like to see change somehow. And I don't know how to do that, to be honest. I know one thing, that is when I play in front of any age groups, I leave the gig with new fans. And sometimes I wonder if the word folk should be just obliterated from my press kit. You know?
Yeah.
Because I'm not writing songs for 60-year-olds. I mean, I am, but I'm not writing it for just, you know, the baby boomers. I'm writing songs for, I mean, especially my songs, I think, are geared towards the generation that is on the cusp of being able to make decisions in the world, you know? Not for the retirees.
You said when people leave, you know, and they really appreciate it. I mean, but do you get a sense that you are getting through even to the audiences that you do have?
I would not be doing this career if mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I was making headway with people. I mean, this is just too brutal on everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to stay married and do this job. Like, yeah. It's hard to pay rent and do this job. It's a lot of travel. It's a lot of heartache. And I certainly wouldn't do it if I didn't feel like I was reaching people. And I honestly feel that at the end, all of my gigs, I would go so far to say as on a good night, 9 out of 11 go home inspired and thinking about something they didn't ordinarily, you know, think of. And 2 out of 11 are going home deeply offended. And that, to me, is success. Yeah. If I can offend 2 out of 11 people and inspire 9, I feel like I've found my vocation.
Well, John Brooks, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. We're going to play a song off your album to take us out. What are we going to hear?
Cage Fighter. Speaking of the folk tradition again, this is one thing that's the pugilist song has always been a prominent type of ballad in folk tradition, and I wanted to do one that was sort of updated in the 21st century. So this is about a cage fighter who was once a child soldier in Bosnia, and it's in part based on a true story.
This is Cage Fighter off of the album Delicate Cages by John Brooks.
Well, they called me the Sarajevo Sandman. I had a lightside kick to the head. It was the cage that taught me how to love as I killed. It was the cage that taught me never to hate. I was a child soldier back home in Tuzla. I've been fighting men since I was 10. I wore my dead brother's football jersey, throwing grenades made of Coca-Cola cans. I had a battery acid smell in my throat. It was the smell of adrenaline. In the cage I felt Santa fell closest to God. In the cage I loved and never feared a thing. And I still miss the river Bosna. I miss that green water now and again.
Artist John Brooks will perform tomorrow at 2 p.m. at Flat, Black, and Circular in East Lansing, and at 7 p.m. as part of the Pump House Concert Series. The Pump House is located at 368 Orchard Street in East Lansing.
Oh, I wish I was still in the cage where I loved more than I feared. Where I loved more than I feared. Yeah, we got out soon after the war. We had a mattress on the floor on Islington. And back home, Dad was an economist.
Stand-up comedy and a Canadian cable access TV show landed Tom Green on MTV back in the 90s. His goofy demeanor and practical jokes made him a star. These days, he's back on the stand-up circuit with 4 shows Friday and Saturday at Connections Comedy Club in Lansing. Current State's Scott Pohl recently talked with Tom Green about the silliness of his early work and what his comedy is like now that he's a little older. And an alert to sensitive listeners, Green uses language that some might find offensive.
I want to talk with you a little bit about the pranks that really got you noticed on MTV. A couple of different kinds of pranks, and the first one I want to describe is the sort of thing where, for instance, you went into a grocery store, grabbed a bottle of window cleaner that had been, the blue liquid inside had been replaced with just blue water, and in front of a clerk in the store, you opened the bottle and started drinking from it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I did that to my grandmother when I was 6.
Yeah, do you sell Windex?
Yeah.
Windex?
Yeah.
Do you know where that is?
Yeah.
Let me just check this here. Is this safe to have around children?
No, I can't let you do that.
It's okay. No, I just want to check.
You're freaking me out.
I just want to check it because I have a small child. I want to make sure he's okay.
Well, your small child probably shouldn't drink it, and neither should you.
I'm okay. I'm an adult.
Oh, my God. Seriously?
No, there's no problem. I think this will be fine, actually. I'll get this. All right, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Cheers.
The other thing, I felt so sorry for your parents over the years, the way you would show up at their house in the middle of the night and barge in, cameras rolling, to pull some sort of a stunt on them.
I were on the street in front of my parents' house. It's 3:30 in the morning, Sunday night. My parents have to work tomorrow. They have to get up early to work tomorrow. So we're going to go in and we're going to wake them up and we're going to see if they want to watch Bon Jovi live in New Jersey videotape with me. Let's go. There goes the dog. Go. Let's go. Let's go.
Hey, Mom?
Oh. You guys want to go watch this Bon Jovi?
No. Thanks.
Tom,
come on, can we just go down and watch it?
Tom, would you turn off the camera, and I'll come out in a second.
Are you going to watch the movie?
We'll negotiate this.
Daddy?
No, I'm not. I'll go to bed.
Why do you have to come in the middle of the night?
Yeah, well, pranking my parents. I mean, that was, you know, I would prank them a lot when I was a kid, and then we started making these videos and filming them in the middle of the night, barging into their bedrooms and putting it on the public access station, and that's kind of what set off the whole chain of events with the show. Is people just really responded to that stuff. They thought it was ridiculous and hilarious because this was before reality TV existed, and so no one had ever seen anything like it. But, you know, it's fun. You know, it really was a life-changing thing, getting picked up by MTV. It's given me all sorts of great opportunities to tour around and do stand-up, and I can't wait to be in Lansing and partying with everybody. And, you know, we've got all these great fans all around the world that have been following the show on the internet and following the show and the movies and all the things that happened since MTV picked up the show. So it's been very exciting. I'm loving doing stand-up, and I'm really looking forward to coming up there and telling some jokes.
You know, I looked up your recent credits on IMDb for the benefit of people who maybe have lost track of you since the MTV days, and there are lots of acting, directing, producing credits. You, along with your stand-up, have a comedy podcast. You have a YouTube channel. You have really been keeping yourself busy.
Yeah, I've always found ways to generate ideas and be creative and do what I do touring, doing stand-up has really kept me busy the last few years. I've been going all over the world, and I'm actually building a new television studio right now. We're moving into an actual new studio space next week, and we're going to be creating a new TV show, and we're doing some new internet shows and a whole bunch of cool stuff. So it's really, really going to be a big year, and there's going to be a lot of new things that people can tune in and check out starting in October. There's going to be some cool stuff. I can't tell you what it is yet because we're not making the official announcement. There's a new TV show coming, so stay tuned for a new version of the Tom Green Show coming back to American television.
You know, a lot of people considered your material back in those days to be, and I think you would agree, juvenile to at least a certain extent. And I think some people might wonder if you've done some growing up since then in terms of the material you're working on. Would you say that?
Well, anybody that thought that basically didn't understand what they were looking at, right? See, we were actually really changing the way television was made. Very early days of reality TV, and we were going in there and essentially trying to piss off conservative America, right? Piss off conservative people around the world who are sort of a little bit high high strung. And, maybe not as relaxed and, don't really know how to enjoy comedy. You know, they just kind of would like to get mad at things. And, we like to take on authority. We like to take on the serious nature of people. And so that show was just sort of trying to rile people up. But at the same time, you know, it was we were using new technology to make television. And we were doing things in a completely different way. And it really did confuse a lot of people. So anybody that was confused by it, thought it was juvenile, thought it was sophomoric or whatever big words they like to use when they would sort of give us, give us a bad review or whatever, was completely, intentional. I mean, we were trying to, anger these people and confuse them. So, You know, and the smart people got it. You know, people that really understand media understood that this is, you know, not a normal way to make a TV show. And that was really who we were, you know, making it for, the people that were paying attention.
Do you think your audience has evolved in the same way you have then?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we're all getting older, right? And as you get older, you have more experiences, you have more, you know, things to draw on, you have more more concerns in your life and more things that you're interested in. And, you know, that leads to, you know, maybe an interest in stand-up because it is, you know, more of a, you know, a discussion about life and about the world, and it's less of a physical comedy. So, you know, it's cool. So on the people that go see stand-up, that like going to see stand-up, I think are genuinely inquisitive people interested in the world that we're living in. And that's sort of a slightly different layer that you have of people that come to my shows and my stand-up shows. You get a lot of the fans from the old show, and you get a lot of new fans who are just fans of stand-up and want to see some good stand-up.
When you look at material that's fresh in the last year or two, do you see yourself having had some influence on any of today's comics?
Well, one thing, I don't actually watch a lot of stand-up anymore. I just kind of decided to stop watching stand-up comedy, and the reason is because it's frustrating for me because, you know, there's only so many subjects, really, to talk about in this world. We're human beings. We walk around. We have two legs, two arms, you know, a nose, a mouth. You know, we eat food. We breathe oxygen. We have similar experiences and similar issues that bother us all around the world. And when you take comedians and we go out and comment on these things, you know, there can be some overlap. And I don't really like to watch other comedians today because I just sort of don't like seeing somebody talking about social media when I talk a lot about social media, or somebody talking about their addiction to their cell phone when I talk a lot about addictions to my cell phone, because then I start to feel like, oh, geez, maybe I can't talk about that because so-and-so is talking about it. So I've just stopped watching it.
Well, Tom Green will be at Comedy Connections Nightclub in Lansing, two shows Friday night, two more Saturday night. Thank you for spending a few minutes with us. Nice talking with you.
Yeah, great to talk to you, too. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Scott Paul.
It isn't often that Detroit makes it onto the big screen, but when it does, it's sometimes unrecognizable to people who know and love the city. Current State contributor Jeffrey Ray shares these thoughts on Detroit as a character in film.
I'm making a new film. It is about three men who return to their hometown after a long absence. That hometown is Detroit. It took me over 2 years to write, and the thing I struggled with most was how to present the city of Detroit itself. How has Detroit been depicted on the big screen? In the film Four Brothers, a set of racially diverse siblings are tight, tough, and searching Detroit for the man who killed their foster mother. And they don't take no mess from nobody.
No. This is not the talking part, okay? This is the listening part, so shut your mouth.
The hell you standing up for?
You know who I am?
It's warm here.
This band of brothers channels Detroit's reputation as a tough city. But that toughness is paired with a clear pride in their town. This standard genre flick is one of the few contemporary films in which pride is at all associated with the Motor City. But Detroit is hip and sprawling in the film adaptation of Elmore Leonard's novel Out of Sight. The late, great Mr. Leonard often wrote of the city he knew intimately. The film version of Out of Sight moves swiftly across the Detroit landscape, from intercity boxing clubs to downtown hotels to a Bloomfield Hills mansion for the final act. Detroit is still a very tough town populated by crooks, hustlers, bumblers, and a few lovers as well. However, in Out of Sight, the rough and tumble Detroit expands to include the suburbs. But Bloomfield Hills? Really? Music has often been a critical part of movies set in Detroit. With the exception of the Eminem hip-hop-inspired 8 Mile, many of the musical films are period pieces set in the Motown heyday, such as Dreamgirls, inspired by the rise of the Supremes in the 1960s. These historical films seem to harken back to a golden era Detroit, full of energy, art, and opportunity, be it on the GM assembly line or in the studios of Hitsville, USA. They tend to present a very idealized Detroit full of broad American nostalgia, which laments the passing of glorious days and music gone by. The opposite of this idealized Detroit can be seen in one of the most notorious films ever set there, RoboCop.
Come quietly or there will be trouble.
The movie's tagline is, "The future left Detroit behind." Yes, I know there may be a RoboCop statue coming into the city, and yes, I know a RoboCop remake is set for 2014, but that 87 original sealed Detroit's fate in popular culture for the next 25 years. The film depicts a futuristic, violent city in ruin. Out-of-control crime is dealt with by a robot cop who hands out a swift brand of justice with no questions asked. Of course, that is always the problem. Questions do need to be asked. Complexities need to be examined. Detroit is a tough city, yet a city of heart. It is a city of corruption, yet a city of folks trying to make it every day. It is bankrupt, but it is a city of art and music, from hip-hop to soul to techno to classical. The characters in my film both love and hate Detroit at the same time. That is not a contradiction. For any filmmaker depicting Detroit, the struggle is not to be trapped by an idealized past, nor by the notion of a futureless city. For artists who care, the struggle is to present Detroit as a character that is flawed and vital, frustrating and thrilling, as only Detroit itself can be. For Current State, I'm Jeffrey Ray.
Jeffrey Ray is an MSU professor and filmmaker. You can hear Jeffrey's film commentaries on the last Friday of every month here on Current State. That's our show for today. Coming up Monday on Current State, it's time for Month in Review. We'll assess September's most impactful Michigan news stories with our panel of experts. That and more on Current State on Monday. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroff is the producer. Thanks also to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Emmanuel Berry, and you've been listening to Current State here on WKAR.